This is Roger Molina on Creative Disturbance. I'm delighted today to be with David McPhail here at the University of Texas, Dallas, where David has just taken up a new distinguished chair, which he's going to tell us about. So David, welcome. Tell us about what you do and what your position here entails.
Well, thank you very much for that welcome, Roger. I'm delighted to be here. I've come across the pond from Imperial College, where I was for 26 years and 3 months, which is a marathon in years. I enjoyed every minute of it. My scientific expertise is in surface analysis, especially using beams of charged particles, which is to say ions, to interrogate and analyze the surfaces of a lot of different materials. So I'm essentially interested in how solid surfaces interact with their environment, and this has been my career history. One aspect of that is how the surfaces of museum objects interact with their environment, and the study of the ultra-slow corrosion processes that take place in those materials. The objective of the research is to find ways of slowing down or stopping the degradation of those museum objects. And so in my current post, I'm going to be working extremely closely with a lot of different museums in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, particularly the Dallas Museum of Art to begin with, and the Amon Carter Museum, on a number of projects focused on conservation science.
And you came here with a collaborator, I think, or you have a close collaborator?
Amy Walker, yeah, in the materials department, yeah, has a time-of-flight secondary ion mass spectrometer, oh, which is one of these machines which is very good at measuring very precisely what's going on at the surfaces of materials. The resolution of this instrument is of the order of 1 nanometer. And if you combine that resolution with a sensitivity, it basically tells you what atoms are in the surface of the material. Uh-huh. It's a very simple but very important question, with great sensitivity. So it can measure elements down at the parts per billion level. And clearly this is very important for provenancing objects.
So one of the interesting things about your position is it's a joint appointment between our Edith O'Donnell Institute for Art History and the Chemistry Department. And one of the things that you mentioned earlier today was that conservation science is the ideal interdisciplinary subject. Maybe you can unpack that a little bit.
Well, yes, indeed. And I think clearly, conservation science is right at the intersection of analytical science, and there are a very large number of techniques which are available to understand the chemistry and the morphology of surfaces and how they are changing with time. And this is clearly of great importance to conservation scientists and curators, whose ultimate aim is to extend the useful life of objects for future generations. But above and beyond that, of course, this activity intersects with the work of art historians, potentially with archaeologists, a number of different fields all coming together at that intercept.
But also, as you mentioned, the same diagnostic techniques, analytic techniques, are used in forensic science, they're used in semiconductor physics, yes, and other areas. And so, indeed, you have a hybrid interest of how these techniques cross.
Yeah, and I think it's absolutely fascinating that the techniques that are rather expensive and sophisticated ultra-high vacuum techniques, which can cost many millions of dollars and are being used for nanoscience and nanotechnology at the cutting edge of research and product development, are ideally suited for measuring the very slow changes that take place on the surfaces of museum objects. If I may expand that a little bit, one of the very obvious and very big issues in any museum-based work is that the conservators and curators are rather reluctant for us to take big samples out of their objects away for scientific analysis. Indeed, oftentimes they're reluctant for us to take any material whatsoever. And yet, for my particular technique, mass spectrometry, it's essential that I have a little bit of material in order to get the information that I need. So there's a sort of very interesting issue here of, are we actually allowed to take a very small amount of sample, perhaps from the edge of a painting or perhaps a little bit of glass that's fallen off an object, in order to understand the chemistry of that material and to begin to empower our ability to advise on conservation.
Yeah, one of the points that you made was also that given that these diagnostic techniques now are working at the nano level, mm-hmm. you can actually analyze surface properties in ways that are unprecedented.
Absolutely, and if I take the example, I've done quite a lot of work on ancient glass and glass from countries such as Venice from several hundred years ago. If you do the math, I think it's called math in this country, and look at a corrosion rate of 1 nanometer per day, which is really, really slow. That's about 3 atomic layers changing per day, then if you wait long enough, if you wait a few thousand years, that becomes a millimeter of material falling off the glass surface. And so conventionally, people just haven't been able to measure such slow rates of corrosion. And what this modern surface analysis technique gives us is the ability to measure these sorts of corrosion rates under realistic conditions. Well, in days gone by, because you couldn't measure with that degree of precision, people would do accelerated aging tests, so they'd heat samples up and they'd put them into conditions of very high humidity. And there's been a lot of debate about that, because a lot of people would say that if you create these artificial conditions, if you heat a glass up to 70 or 80 or 90 degrees centigrade, then you could well be putting in place processes that will never happen at room temperatures, and so the information may not be relevant or valid.
Just to keep on your Venetian glass anecdote, you also mentioned that in fact Venetian glassblowers were known for their heavy beer drinking, and so that in fact when you analyze the inside of the glass and the outside, you actually get different chemical properties.
I believe that's true. I don't think you can differentiate between red and white wine.
Can you actually differentiate between one glassblower and another?
I think potentially you could, and we're back in the area of forensic sciences.
So that's fascinating. One of the things that you also mentioned was this very natural tension between analysis and research. So that sometimes people might come to you as a conservation scientist and they really want a cheap analysis of a chemical property of something, mm-hmm. or at the same time you're interested in then converting those into a research program.
Sure.
So explain that tension and the kinds of analyses that you've done in the past that...
Yeah, I'm not sure tension is quite the right word, but there are going to be circumstances where people have a very straightforward research, have a straightforward question, which is, you could have some lead printing, some printing blocks, for example, some metallic printing blocks, and the conservator would simply want to know what the major elements in those blocks were, and a very straightforward analysis in the electron microscope with energy dispersive X-ray analysis would tell you within a few minutes, for example, is there any lead in that metal? And you could repeat that experiment 100 times on 100 different printing blocks and get that answer. Now, that's important and necessary information, and it's an important aspect of what I'm going to be doing. But that sort of routine, repetitive analysis does not constitute a research program for a PhD or a master's student.
So one of the things you've been doing in the few months you've been here is that you've been going around the museums in the Dallas Metroplex, understanding the collections they have. You've been talking to the curators, trying to understand the problems they're facing in terms of conservation and restoration. Yep. So tell us a little bit about what the landscape looks like to you.
Well, the landscape is very rich. That's the first thing to say. And if you and your listeners go to the Dallas Museum of Art, I know you've been many times, you will see many different types of object, many different types of materials on display, wood and ceramics and metals, and textiles and so forth. And each of those different materials types presents different conservation problems, which leads to a very interesting debate about what we should prioritize. And so in deciding what we're prioritizing, we're looking for projects where research can be undertaken by master's students and PhD students, so that's one of the main drivers.
And you've already identified a few topics that you think would lend themselves to PhD or master's thesis?
Yeah.
I know there was an Inca textile on your list.
There was an Inca textile, and understanding the One of the great mysteries in all of this is understanding the processes that were used to actually fabricate the objects in the first place, and what sort of, how were the colours imparted. If one looks at some of the textiles in the museum, the colours remain extremely bright after hundreds of years, and understanding the pigments that were used and what's giving them their longevity and why they're remaining as brilliant as they are is a very interesting aspect of things. Of course, to come back to an earlier point, ideally we'd like to be able to do some forensic analysis on one of the threads there and get one of the threads out and put it through a whole battery of analytical techniques to understand those sort of questions around the pigmentation being used.
You also used the phrase object-based science in the service of art. Mm. And so it's sort of an interesting thing, and as I mentioned to you, we've been having some discussions here about how people identify approaches for working on things, and I talked about problem-based, project-based, process-based, and object-based.
Yes.
And so indeed it's sort of interesting when the object is the starting point for the discussion, mm-hmm. And to talk about a little bit about that.
Well, I was really keen to do that, and when I met the conservators down at the museums, I engaged them in a conversation around that aspect of things. It seems to me that there are many different ways in which scientific research projects can evolve, but to be most useful in a conservation science program, we need to start off with the painting or the sculpture or the marble or whatever it is, and ask the questions of the conservators and curators: what do we need to do to understand the processes going on the surface of this material, to slow down the degradation and increase the useful life of this object so that many more future generations can see it?
As part of the presentation you gave here, you showed a painting by Remington, mm-hmm. of a number of cowboys on horses, mm-hmm. and you asked us what that picture made us think about. Tell us about the impulse for that.
One of the things that's become very clear to me when I go around and engage with people and visit the museums and so forth is that if you take a physical painting, it's a physical object, and you're assessing it with your eyes at one level. But if you drill down beyond that, it means lots of different things to lots of different people. So with my science hat on, I'm interested in doing a full characterization of that as an object made up of atoms, and finding out what atoms were used in the pigments, and what the materials are that make up the backdrop of the painting and so forth. So it's a physical object for characterization, and that's just one way of looking at it. Other people would be looking at it in terms of it's where it sits in the context of artistic objects in that museum. I guess other people might be looking at it as something potentially to buy and put up in their home as an investment. If you're responsible for shipping it across the Atlantic and you're a shipping company, then you look at it from the point of view of how do we mitigate risk and avoid damaging the object during transit. Other people might be looking at it in terms of its authenticity. Is it really a Remington or not? And so there are so many different ways in which people can look at one single object.
And as I mentioned, I'm going to introduce you to Paul Fishwick, because we just submitted a funding proposal on object-based deep personalization.
Right.
And so
I look forward to that.
Really interested in the topic. We just have a couple of minutes left. One of the things that you also have discussed is how in the kind of projects you're involved in, collaboration is an essential methodology, and the difficulties and the powers of that. Tell us a little bit about collaboration and your experience with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm very interested in how collaborations come about, and in my particular case, the first introduction to the Victoria and Albert Museum was essentially through a mentor, mm-hmm. who had been collaborating with them before and who took me under his wing, so to speak, and took me across the road from Imperial College to the V&A Museum. And I met some people in the glass conservation section, and that sort of catalyzed things, and we began to do things together through undergraduate student projects, master's projects, and so forth. So you know, if he hadn't walked me across the road,
yeah,
hadn't taken me under his wing, it's quite possible that none of that would actually have happened. Again, we spoke about the example of somebody picking up an article and reading about a scientist at Imperial College. If she had to picked up that magazine and read that particular article, collaboration might not have taken place, which actually led to a case study which was submitted by the college as one of its examples of excellence in research during the recent REF exercise. So I'm very interested in the sort of accidental way, if you like, the serendipitous way in which some of these collaborations come about. And so there's what flows from that as a question. Should we just allow these things to happen accidentally, or should we perhaps be putting structures in place to increase the overlap integral, if you like, between people who might be able to usefully work together and form a productive team?
Yeah, and this is a hot topic internationally, the whole issue of collaboration, how you train people to collaborate, are there best practices to enable collaboration? And indeed, part of that is creating the conditions for serendipity to happen,
sure,
in particular areas or particular directions. And I think it is a very interesting issue. In the case of the collaboration you mentioned, as you said, the Imperial College is mostly known for its science and engineering, and they featured a project in art conservation as one of its exemplars, mm-hmm, of excellence in research. But also the collaboration involved working with people in different institutions, which immediately, yes, poses problems. And in your case, with people of very different ages and points of their career, where there was a student whose whole life depended, mm-hmm, on the success of this project.
Yeah, and I think when, as academics, we're always mindful of the fact that our first and last duty is to our students, and to ensure that when we're designing research projects for them at the undergraduate or the postgraduate level, that there are multiple pathways to success,
yep,
and we do due diligence to make sure that nobody sort of... I ran a half-day workshop for scientists and museum conservators in the sort of South Kensington area of London, flowing from Prince Albert's 1851 concept of collaboration, and brought about 120 people together, I think I'm right in saying. And at the end of that afternoon, first thing to say is a lot of people get an afternoon off work who wouldn't be able to get a day off work and certainly wouldn't be able to get a week off work. And we followed that up at the end of the afternoon with a wine reception. And so this is not complicated. It's bringing people together for a short period of time and then putting them in the same room. And people were coming up to me at the end of that wine reception saying, I've met A, B, C, and D, and we're going to talk some more and,
yeah,
and get together. So, you know, it's about bringing people together often and regularly, and you don't need a huge conference to do
we're
that.
We're going to have to wrap this up, but indeed, there's this, and again, I don't know why the word tension is in my mind at the moment, between the silos of our university departments,
yes,
and the desire to do interdisciplinary research. So everybody's for interdisciplinarity,
yep,
but actually finding half a day to spend time with,
yep,
people outside of your field is often not part of the landscape.
This is really important, and there's sort of massive discussion around, A, when do scientists get time to think? And B, when do scientists get time to talk to each other? And I think these are freeing them up to have those opportunities is really important, because a lot of, if not all of the stuff that's really good comes by bringing people together from disparate disciplines to brainstorm.
Okay, very good. On that
right.
Pregnant note, we're going to have to end this discussion. Thank you, David, so much for joining us on Creative Disturbance.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Amen.